You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I am your host, Daniel Meyer. It is an absolutely beautiful day here in New York, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Elizabeth Yu, Executive Director of Finance for Food. And author of a new book that a lot of people are quite excited about. It's called Raising Dough, The Complete Guide to Financing a Socially Responsible Food Business. For everybody out there, hopefully some people listening, who've ever had that spark of a brilliant idea for a food business, but ignored it or sort of let it fade away because all of the financial obstacles to getting it off the ground. This is most certainly the book, and Elizabeth is most certainly the woman for you. So, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. So, a testament to how jazzed up everybody seems to be about this book that you've written is that this is the second time in the last 2 months, I think, that Elizabeth has been on Heritage Radio to talk about the book. Last month was on Kathy Airway's show, and it was a great show. So, before we jump too deep into the book itself, I'm wondering why now is the time to write this book? What's happening or what's been happening in our food landscape that makes it such a crucial topic to explore now?
Well, it's both because of what's happening in the food landscape and what's happening in the financial landscape. I think that this book is timely. In the food landscape, I think we're seeing a huge uptick in the number of entrepreneurs who are starting food businesses. And then within that as well, we're seeing entrepreneurs who are starting food businesses specifically to address social or environmental problems. There's quite a few different types of food businesses that are doing this, whether it's creating food access in communities that don't generally have access to fresh food or healthy vegetables. Maybe they only have liquor stores and fast food restaurants. So we're seeing an increasing number of healthy corner stores or mobile food trucks or food markets, bringing food into food deserts, as they're increasingly being known. Mm-hmm. And then we're seeing, you know, a wide range of socially responsible food businesses. And then within the financing landscape, there's a huge number of new ways that people are financing businesses. And it's a wild west of financing. And we're seeing an increasing number of crowdfunding platforms, online fundraising platforms, community supported financing mechanisms, a lot of new ways to finance food businesses or any type of business, really, that are beyond the usual suspects.
Yeah, I definitely want to get to all of those in just a little bit. I'm wondering, you know, with the sort of recent upsurge in food businesses, especially ones that are addressing sort of social issues and issues of sustainability, you know, I'm wondering, there was a time probably not that long ago when sustainable food businesses existed really only on the fringes. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the history of how those kinds of businesses have progressed and how their role and sort of import in our culture has changed or progressed over the years.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of people, when they think of socially responsible food businesses, think of some of the first generation natural or organic food businesses. Uh-huh. Like Ben & Jerry's or Odwalla. These were some of the earliest really large and well-known businesses that people were recognizing in terms of brands that were talking about social justice or not using ingredients that had been somehow harming the environment as they were being produced. And I think a lot of people also, when they saw what happened as these businesses grew and then ultimately ended up selling to large multinational corporations, it really spawned a whole movement of smaller community scale food businesses that were really addressing the needs of their immediate communities, and a new wave of entrepreneurs who are really committed to keeping ownership local, or at least keeping ownership within the realm of a business that was a much smaller scale but could perhaps keep more of the sustainable values at their core, even as the business evolved over time.
Right. So I'm wondering about a company like, you know, like Ben & Jerry's, like you mentioned. You know, what does it mean when a company that started out very small and with a certain set of values grows to the point where they're, I don't know, too big to operate within themselves and have to sell to a giant company. I think Unilever was the company that bought Ben and Jerry's. You know, is that, are there any benefits to that? You know, does anybody who cares about small sustainable food businesses win in that scenario, or is it just a big, is it just a big takeover?
Well, that's actually a really interesting case, and it's one of learning more about the case of Ben & Jerry's is actually why I got into this field over 10 years ago at this point. And initially, they, as Ben & Jerry's started to become more successful, they wanted to offer ownership shares to people who were residents of the state of Vermont because they recognized that without these diehard fans and their community members in Vermont, the company never would have achieved any success at all. And so they wanted to share the financial success
right.
With Vermont shareholders. So they offered what is known as a direct public offering, a small offering with a really low minimum investment amount so that, you know, at one point, a huge percent of the people in Vermont were actually shareholders of Ben & Jerry's. And so they started out with very good intentions, but they realized that after a lot of people wanted to realize the return on the investment as the company was growing, and they didn't have any way to sell those shares again. There was no one available to sell the shares back. So that's when they listed the stock on a public exchange, in this case, NASDAQ exchange.
Uh-huh.
And that was the beginning of a slippery slope that ultimately ended up in, it wasn't just that the company had gotten so big that they needed to be taken over by a large multinational corporation. It just meant that they were then beholden by certain laws that meant in the event that someone offered to buy the company, they had to choose the highest bidder. And so even though and Ben Cohen in particular, one of the founders, really did not want the sale to go through, and they tried to figure out other ways to buy back all of these shares, they had to go with the highest bidder, in which case that was Unilever. So they didn't want to sell, and it's kind of a heartbreaking story. And that's when I realized we really needed to be focusing on ways to help these food entrepreneurs finance their businesses that would allow them to keep the values in the business, and if they wanted to keep ownership local or small, or keep the management of the company close to home, we had to figure out ways of letting them do that.
Yeah, so I want to get to what those ways are in a second, but could you tell us what in your, obviously you said you mentioned 10 years ago you were interested in looking at the case of Ben & Jerry's. What in your background sort of led you to this work or prepared you for it?
Well, I've always been really passionate about food as an amazing leverage point for addressing many of the social issues of our time. And you don't have to dig too deeply to see how it affects issues like public health and the obesity and diabetes epidemics. It also obviously affects the health of our watersheds and our ecological systems, but it can be a really important driver for economic activity and economically depressed areas, and you know, it's the list goes on and on of all the different social issues that food can be a part of helping solve. And
mm-hmm.
so that was why I was interested in the food space. And then it was again because of my experience and conversations with entrepreneurs like the founders Ben and Jerry, like the founder of Odwalla, and looking at how they're financing choices or lack of choices many years ago, that was more the case, had led them down these paths that they hadn't necessarily meant to go down. I think that's really what sparked my interest in looking particularly at the financing structures.
So can you tell us a little bit about your about the nonprofit that you run, Finance for Food? I mean, obviously the mission of it seems to be closely tied into what you're exploring in the book, but how did it come about, and what are the services that you provide?
Sure. So I had spent 10 years, I was in the middle of an MBA program in sustainable management when I first met Ben Cohen and Greg Stoutenpole of Odwalla and started having these conversations. And then after I graduated from that program, I worked for three different organizations, all of them nonprofit, that serve the purpose of connecting investors who were looking for companies that were addressing social or environmental issues with companies that were creating social good through their operations. And throughout all of these, I was focusing both on sustainable food systems and how we could really activate more community capital. So it wasn't just large institutional investors, but it's also individual people. How can we take advantage of this increasing interest in moving people's investments off of Wall Street? I mean, a lot of everyday folks, especially after the economic fallout after 2008, really wanted to move their money off of Wall Street
right.
and start investing in the types of businesses that were making up the communities they wanted to be a part of. And so really capitalizing upon, literally upon this interest in moving people's money. And it increasingly became clear to me over the course of this work that although there were more and more options for raising capital for socially responsible businesses, and in particular food businesses, there was no easy way for people to navigate this very complicated and ever-evolving and shifting capital markets landscape. And so over and over, I was wishing that I could tell people, well, no, you know, we have this great loan fund, but you're not eligible yet. I wanted to send them to some website or some guidebook that would tell them, like, here are your other options, and here's how you can determine which is a good fit given your priorities and your values and where you are in your business life cycle. And that just it didn't exist. And I had this frustration for so many years. I finally realized I had to take my experience in the field and turn it into the book that hadn't existed yet, so that I could put this valuable tool in people's hands and they could find the money they were looking for.
So you literally wrote the book on this topic.
I had to.
So I imagine that there are, I'm hoping that there are some people listening out there who have really great ideas for ventures in food and sustainable food, but have no idea where to start. Aside from telling them to go out and immediately buy and read your book, what's the first piece of advice that you'd give to someone like that?
The very first piece of advice is to ask a whole lot of questions. So if you have an idea, say, to open a new food cart or something, talk to other people who have already done it. Ask them what they wish they had known before they had started. And there's a common adage in the fundraising world, if you ask for money, you'll get advice. If you ask for advice, you'll get money. Of course, it's not always true. But the earlier you start asking as many questions as you can, not only will that help you refine your business plan, but you may also have accidentally identified some of your future investors as well.
And is there a common mistake that you find that people who are starting up, maybe someone who's started asking questions and is starting to build a business, are there common pitfalls that you feel like hinder people at the beginning?
Yeah, I think the most common pitfall relates very closely to my favorite piece of advice for people starting any type of business, really, is to do your homework up front and really spend some time identifying the key values that are really at the heart of why you're starting this business in the first place. So especially when it comes to socially responsible businesses, I think a lot of really passionate, mission-oriented people, they want to do everything. So they want to have a company that's only going to sell organic food that's grown within 10 miles and is all fair trade and was raised by formerly incarcerated people that, you know, you name it. And then they very quickly realize when they start the business that that's actually impossible, and maybe they live in the Northeast, like where you are.
Right.
And there aren't actually a whole range of fruits and vegetables that are available around the entire growing season. And, you know, so this is one of the common pitfalls. But beyond identifying what's actually feasible for starting a business, you also want to make sure that you have identified and prioritized and really clearly articulated your values for yourself, so that when it comes time to finding partners, and whether that's other people to run the business with you, employees, or importantly, also your financial partners, prospective investors or lenders, you want to make sure that you're on the same page, so that when push comes to shove, you are in agreement about some of the hard decisions that might need to be made. And this is where we see over and over some of the heartbreaking stories, or when people have just assumed that any money is good money, and they bring investors in that don't share their values, and then they don't necessarily realize that by selling equity, for instance, selling stock in their company to raise money, they've also often sold management rights, or voting rights. And sometimes they end up in a position where they're having to they're getting outvoted at the boardroom table, or the investors are forcing them down a path that they didn't want to go down. And so that's why it's so important to be really spending the time up front, identifying your values and making sure that you're shopping around for partners who share those values.
So before, I want to dive in a second, or maybe after a break, to the sort of nitty gritty of the financing options available to people. But before that, I'm wondering, you know, your book is a guide to financing socially responsible food businesses. How is that different from financing, you know, socially irresponsible food businesses, or at least ones that don't particularly, you know, articulate social responsibility in their missions? Is it markedly different? Are there really different paths that you take based on your values?
Well, admittedly, most of the financial tools are applicable in any situation, whether you're sort of a rape and pillage type company or one that is trying to solve these social or environmental problems.
Right.
But what's different in the case of socially responsible businesses is that they're often taking into account a number of stakeholders beyond just their shareholders. And so there's a whole additional range of considerations that you might want to build into your financing agreements. The other challenge is that a lot of the more traditional sources of financing and the people in those positions, whether it's at the bank or it's some venture capital firm or even when it comes to friends and family loans, if people aren't used to socially responsible businesses and some of the decisions that you might be making as you're operating these businesses or growing them, you know, if the assumption is that you're just operating with as business as normal, then you might find yourself in a position, again, where you're compromising the values upon which you founded your business. So I just want to make sure that people understand if they're using some of the more traditional tools, or even if they're using some of the more innovative and cutting-edge financing tools, as a socially responsible entrepreneur, there's additional considerations to keep in mind. And there are some helpful tips and terms that you can build into your financing agreements to help protect some of those values.
Okay, we are going to get to those particular financing mechanisms in just a second. We're talking with Elizabeth Yu. We need to take a quick break, but we will be right back. Stay tuned.
She's dancing by herself in a mother's summer dress. Oh, kid, she doesn't need your help. She studied art in Spain. Tall boys across her brain. It's all boys, men, they'll do anything. They sat her in the shade, threw her a parade, all lined up, marching back and forth all day. She's boy crazy. She's boy crazy. Oh, she's boy.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Elizabeth Yu, author of Raising Dough, The Complete Guide to Financing a Socially Responsible Food Business. So we've sort of been talking around the edges about these various financial mechanisms for socially responsible food businesses to fund themselves. But now I want to sort of get into the nitty-gritty. What are they? How do they work? You know, so I'm wondering... I had a guest on the show a few months ago. We were talking about farming and how lack of access to capital can be a really significant barrier for, you know, new farmers trying to purchase land and get a start. Is there a similar scenario that plays out with food businesses? Is startup money hard to come by, or is there plenty of it around if you know where to look for it?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because the whole concept of quote, lack of access to capital, that term is one of my pet peeves, because there's many
great. Different I'm glad I used it so we can get into it.
You know, so often it's not necessarily that there is no money around it. It is, like you said, that people don't know where to look.
Right.
That's one part of the challenge. But another part of it is that a lot of people simply don't have the business savvy that it takes to be eligible or even have a conversation with the types of financiers that might consider investing in their businesses. So there's also a financial education part of it. And then again, and part of why I wrote the book too, is a social justice issue around the barrier of language when it comes to finance. A lot of people just aren't comfortable talking about finance, or they've just never heard of some of the terms that bankers or other investors throw around. So I'm really committed to using simple language to talk about finance to help encourage other people to become more comfortable talking about money. So that's part of it. But yes, you're absolutely right. Just in the same way that young farmers have a challenge accessing capital for a variety of reasons,
right.
Food startups have a hard time accessing capital too. But I don't agree that there just isn't money around. Again, there's so many individual people, future or current customers that would be interested in investing. So often it's just that folks aren't asking their neighbors and community members to invest in their projects. But especially with a lot of the online fundraising platforms now, like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, we're seeing a really increasing number of folks that are actively asking their community members for financing. And I think that's really exciting.
So let's talk about money. Say I'm starting a responsible food business, and I need to know where to look to get funding. What are the, you mentioned, you mentioned Kickstarter and Indiegogo, which I want to ask you about. What are the various options, maybe some of the more innovative, less traditional, maybe community-based models that I should look to get a start?
Sure. So one of the models that a lot of people are familiar with, especially with regard to farming, is community-supported agriculture. So this nowadays, right, most people know of this as a method of pre-selling products that you'll deliver later. So like a subscription box of fruits and vegetables where people pay in advance. Maybe they pay for 3 months in advance, maybe 6 months or even a year. Mm-hmm. And then every week they get a box of fruits and veggies. So we're seeing a lot more community-supported financing models in other types of food businesses. So whether it's breweries or bakeries or restaurants, some startups are selling subscriptions before the restaurant has even opened, or other retail location. And then other existing restaurants, let's say they want to build a new outdoor patio. So they'll engage their existing customers in a campaign, a community supported financing campaign, and sell gift certificates to raise the money that they need to build this new patio. So that's one example. Some of the other examples include tapping into local networks such as the Slow Money Network, and I know there's an active one in New York, where Slow Money is an organization that is a national organization that has local chapters around the country, and mm-hmm. these are people, primarily investors, who are really actively engaging in the conversation with local small-scale food entrepreneurs and farmers and socially responsible businesses, and really having the conversation about how can we as individual investors provide financing to primarily these smaller food businesses in a way that really makes sense. So we're not just trying to make as much money as we can in a period of time as we can, but we want to actually support these businesses and see them succeed. So people have been really successful getting community loans through the Slow Money Networks. So I definitely recommend that people check that out. And then there's a new online fundraising platform called Credibles that was launched by the Slow Money
Credibles
Network, the national network. Credibles. So like edible credits.
Oh, Credibles. Love that.
Yeah, and that's another way for established businesses to pre-sell products that they will deliver later. And part of why this is really exciting is that when people invest, they'll be eating down their edible credits over time, but for the restaurant or the retail location or the small food purveyor, you know, the cost to them to pay back their investors is only the cost it takes to produce that food, whereas the investors are redeeming their credits at retail value. So it's a great value for the food entrepreneurs who are using this Credibles platform to raise money from their customers. And it's also a great way for people that are really committed to supporting certain, again, whether it's restaurants or small food players.
Yeah.
We have some, like a yogurt maker or sauerkraut producer. If they know they're going to be purchasing products from this business over time, it's a great way for them to show their support and give them money. You know, maybe it's in advance of the growing season where they can get a great deal on ingredients ahead of time.
That.
You know, it's just really nice to help with the cash flow of the business and show your support as a customer as well.
That is great. And there was one thing that I wanted to ask you about in that you mentioned in the book, individual development accounts. You call them something like free money, I think. What are they? How are they free money? How do we use them?
Yes, well, it is, in fact, the closest thing to free money that I have encountered, although very few people are actually eligible for these programs.
Okay.
So I hope that some of your listeners who are
okay.
hearing this right now and can go check them out. But several economic development agencies or microfinance providers, so these are financial organizations that are providing very small loans to help people start businesses, and they're often working in underserved areas, or they're working with people of color or women or minorities
mm-hmm.
often, and in certain cases, they have these individual development account programs. They're known as IDAs for short,
okay.
individual development accounts, and it's combined financial literacy training program and matched savings program. So let's say if you have a microfinance provider in New York, I'm sorry, I don't know an actual example, but for every dollar that an eligible saver would save and contribute mm-hmm. to their savings account, that money would be matched one-to-one, or sometimes even two, up to $7 would come from another philanthropic source and match your savings up to a certain limit. And this can be really helpful in helping people start businesses. Often it can be used to help pay for citizenship paperwork, it's often a limiting factor for small business people, or you know, others are using it to buy a car to help them deliver the food that they're producing. So it can be a great source of extra cash for people who are eligible.
Wow. We have a great system of campaign finance for matching funds that works similarly in New York. So it's good to know that it's happening with food businesses too. So we were talking. I want to get back to what we were talking about, sort of at the beginning, with the Ben and Jerry's story and the idea of sustainable growth for sustainable business. Is there a model or a roadmap for how a small food business with a certain set of values, you know, grows and expands while continuing to keep those values in place and not getting too big to lose them? Have you experienced ways for small businesses to be successful in that regard?
Right. Well, one thing is that I want to challenge the assumption that a large business cannot be successful. Every entrepreneur is different, and everyone has a different reason for starting a business in the first place. I mean, it is funny to say that only a small business can be successful. That definitely flies in the face of traditional business.
Or I guess
logic,
the bigger you get, the harder it is to hold on to your core values, maybe.
Right. Well, then that can be true. But if your goal and your interest in leveraging social change involves having a really, really large company that has a really wide-reaching impact, then you know, it's really up to the individual entrepreneur's mindset and theory of change. And so I think for me, what's more important than saying there's one way to do it right is that you, again, like we said earlier in this conversation, make sure you understand what your values are and what your vision of success includes, and then make sure you're finding ways of operating your business that align with those values. And in particular, make sure you're choosing financing mechanisms that make sense given those values, because not every type of financing is appropriate for every business model. Everyone wants to grow at a different rate. Everyone wants to grow to a different size. If you haven't spent any time thinking about that, you might just end up getting taken for a ride based on where your funders want you to go rather than what your intention was.
So we've been talking about this a lot from the business perspective, but at every point we're mentioning investors and people who are sort of putting their money into these companies. Are there ways for, you know, say I go to the farmer's market every week and spend money on supporting a local sustainable farmer, an artisan, or some producer? Other than that, what are ways that I can show my support for these kinds of businesses, or physically invest my money or buy stock, or how do we do that as you know, non-philanthropists and regular people?
Right, and who want to actually see a financial return on their investment and not just give the money away as a gift.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's a little bit complicated now. Because of the way that securities regulations work, it's often illegal for businesses to publicly announce that they're even looking for investors. And this is particularly true if they're trying to raise money from non-wealthy investors. So to make a long story short, the laws make it easier for rich people to invest than they do for those of us that don't have that much money.
Not tremendously surprising, but
these laws are changing now, and the Crowdfunding Act of 2012 was supposed to make it easier, but the at the end of the day, it still means that it's very difficult for entrepreneurs to announce that they're looking for investors. So as somebody who's motivated to support specific companies, there's nothing that prevents you from asking if they are looking to raise capital. And I think probably the easiest way that this is done is usually not by selling stock, because that is very complicated and usually involves an attorney, and that gets very expensive. But people can create their own loan agreements fairly easily using free promissory note templates that are available online. And then in the book, I do outline some terms that you might want to include to help protect both the investor and the entrepreneur's values. But there's definitely ways that you can formulate loan agreements, friends and family loans, or loans from other community members. And again, as an interested investor, you can study up on how to create some of these loan agreements and make an offer. And you know, I would not be surprised if a lot of the business folks at the booths that people are patronizing at the farmers market would be interested in having that conversation. But again, I also encourage people to become part of the Slow Money chapter in New York and start having that conversation along with community members who have really been spending a lot of time, you know, several years at this point, really having that conversation about how to best structure investment deals and also how to collectively think about, you know, either examining business plans to see if it's a good investment decision in the first place, but or also helping those businesses through advice and other types of coaching. So maybe it's not money that might be the best contribution that you can make. It's advice or your network.
Right. So
there's many ways that people can contribute.
If you talk to the actual business owners and see what they might need, that might be the way to make yourself most useful as a supporter.
Mm-hmm. And it might be, here's my business card. Give me a call after the market and let them continue to make their sales.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
At the market might not be the best time to have that conversation.
Very, very good. Okay, so we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you one question before I let you go. And this requires a little peering into the future. But if you had to guess at what our sort of food marketplace might look like in this country, say in 20 years or 30 years, somewhere down the road, what do you imagine? Are we going to become a more responsible, socially responsible food economy by a lot of small, sustainable businesses taking more share from big corporations? Or are we going to see a sort of more top-down shift where big food companies start to reform themselves for, I don't know, any number of reasons and become more responsible? Do you have any sense of where we're headed and how we get to the point that you're sort of working towards?
Well, I'm going to answer that question optimistically and in alignment with my own hopeful vision of the future.
Okay,
so I would
love
to see the former case that you described, where there's a lot more smaller, independently held businesses that are serving the needs of their community. And we're seeing communities that have the food sovereignty to be able to grow and produce and process and distribute and sell their own food that's coming from their local areas, and a network of fair trade relationships between different communities that are able to produce different products in season. You know, obviously we're never going to be growing chocolate. Well, I hope we're never going to be growing chocolate and coffee in North America, but you never know.
Climate change
is going. So yeah, I mean, that my vision is definitely of a network of interconnected and democratically operated and run businesses that are really tapped into the local needs and providing the goods and services that we need locally, while also being able to have this just trade between regions.
Okay, well, I will end on the optimistic view too. We are out of time. Elizabeth, I want to thank you so much for chatting with us today. It's been really a pleasure. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I'll talk to you again in a few weeks on the next episode of Good Food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.